Okay, let me officially welcome everyone to today's Conversations with the Masters call with my, I can say, dear friends, Robert and Diane Masters. My name is Mary Allen, and I'm a Master Certified Coach, author of The Power of Inner Choice, and of course, your host of the Conversations with the Masters series. Before I introduce Robert and Diane today, I want to just welcome all of our live listeners, those that are you hanging out on the webcast, and those of you that may be listening to this as a recording. And I want to just thank all of you from the bottom of my heart for spreading the word about these calls. I want to let you know that the call is being recorded, so you can go back and listen again. This is one of those calls where I suspect you'll want to do that because you may be introduced to some brand new ideas. If you have pre-registered for the call, you're going to be receiving a special follow-up email later this week. So feel free to forward that to friends that you think also may be interested in hearing what you hear today. So I want to invite you to clear all distractions. You may pull out a notepad, but really just allow yourself to be with today's call fully. We're diving into the juicy topic of intimacy in relationships. And there's some ideas here that can truly change and transform your life if you're up for that. So a few months ago, some of you may remember that I interviewed Robert Masters about his book, Spiritual Bypassing, and on that call we were talking about how spiritual bypassing shows up in relationship and sort of got to talking, hey, it might be fun to bring Diane back and do another call where it's solely on his book, Transformation Through Intimacy. So that's exactly what we're doing here today. Let me just offer up a more formal introduction. I know some of you already are a big fan of Robert's and know his work. Some of you are just learning about him for the first time. So let me let you know who you're going to be listening to here today. Robert Augustus Masters, PhD, is the author of 11 books, including Spiritual Bypassing and Transformation Through Intimacy. He holds a doctorate in psychology and is a highly experienced psychotherapist, trainer of psychotherapists, and teacher of spiritual deepening. His integral intuitive work has been developed over the past 33 years, and he dynamically blends the psychological and physical with the spiritual, emphasizing embodiment, authenticity, deep shadow work, emotional openness and literacy, and the development of relational maturity. Those who work with him are taught, among other things, how to turn toward and enter their pain so that they might pass through it rather than rising above it or otherwise avoiding it, something we like to do. At Essence, his work is about becoming more intimate with all that we are, dark and light, high and low, shallow and deep, neurotic and transcendent, dying and undying. He and his wife, Diane, work and teach closely together, doing all their group sessions and trainings together. And she, let me tell you a little bit about Diane. Diane Bardwell Masters is an intuitive healer and highly skilled psychotherapist, as well as a longtime songwriter and professional singer. She brings great heart and insight to the work she shares with Robert. 6 years ago, she began bringing her music into the psycho-spiritual world she and Robert share, finding that her singing and words greatly benefited their clients. And it soon became clear that when they were actively singing with her, moving sound through their bodies and minds, and at the same time letting the meaning of the words permeate them, they benefited much more. This way, the words became their own. And out of this arose Emergence, which is Diane's latest CD, which is Contemporary Original Chants in English. And this music really has the ability to heal and awaken. So a little bit something about Diane. And I just have to say that I'm particularly excited about today's call because since our last interview, my husband, John, and I have had the chance to meet Robert and Diane in person when we visited Ashland and did a phenomenal weekend intensive with them. So I now know their work. I know their work firsthand, how powerful it is, what their level of expertise is, and just that we're all really, really blessed to have both of them here on the line today. So welcome, Robert and Diane.
Thank you so much, Mary.
Thanks, Mary.
Great to be here.
Well, it's just a delight to have you here with us. So we're going to be diving into, a lot of juicy topics, and I'm excited to see how many we can get to here today. And, I think the place to start is really around this whole idea of radical intimacy. And I have to say, I was sharing your book title with a friend of mine, and she sort of squealed a little bit like, ooh, that sounds like really scary. So maybe you could maybe do a little disclaimer here. Tell us what radical intimacy is about, and should we be scared? And
Well, first of all, Mary, it is scary at times because we are pushing an edge. But I like to say it's scary/exciting.
Mm-hmm.
We're touching the frontiers of certain things. We're leaving our comfort zone at a pace that's fitting for us, but we are leaving our comfort zone. So it is difficult. If it was really easy, we would have all done it a long time ago. We would have been in deep relationship, be happy, centered most of the time. The fact that we're not points to the need to do some serious work with this. And the good news is that work is doable. The results are very, very strong, and if we practice doing deep work on ourselves in the context of an intimate relationship, we'll find that the work goes quickly, effectively, and it lasts.
Mm.
Because in an intimate relationship, a truly intimate relationship, we, in a sense, can't get away with anything, which can be a pain in the butt sometimes, but it really is a gift. We know we're the partner who can see us, knows us really well, and we feel safe enough with them to allow their critical feedback in when it's necessary.
And when you think about it, it's actually scarier to think about doing a whole lifetime or years and years with someone and not taking those risks.
Yes.
Living partially and only going to a certain level of intimacy and depth with the person that's your partner.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I think that's so true that in relationships that where we get a lot of fulfillment, it can be also a source of pain and longing for something more. And gosh, I want to dive deeper, and yet not knowing quite how to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, in part, to dive deeper in a relationship requires that we dive deep into our work on ourselves. We often say, if you want true intimacy with a partner, you have to also cultivate intimacy with everything that you are: anger, fear, longings, your history, everything that we are. To become intimate with that allows us to become really intimate with another person. So the two things go together, intimacy with oneself, intimacy with others. And to be intimate with oneself or others means that we have to be close enough to them or to that quality in ourselves to know it well, but to also keep it in perspective, to have some focus. Otherwise, our intimacy becomes fusion, meaning we blend with that person or that quality, and we identify with it, and we get lost in it. As in codependency, or if we get too identified with our, for example, our jealousy, our anger, our fear, we can't work with it. So intimacy is a wonderful blend of separation and connection.
Mm.
The connection is implicit, we all know that, but the separation is there, so we have just enough distance from what we're dealing with or experiencing to keep it in focus.
So part of the work is establishing very clear boundaries for ourselves in our lives, just as individuals, and also in relationships, so that when we are with a beloved partner, we are consciously expanding our boundaries to include them, but we still have our autonomy, and we're not just merging and just fusing in this romantic fusion and then suddenly losing all sense of who we really are.
See, in romance, we collapse or dissolve our boundaries, and we become at one with the other, but it's an unconscious oneness. It's not a healthy oneness. In true intimacy, we don't collapse or dissolve our boundaries. We allow them to expand, to include the other. And in doing that, we still have the boundaries, just we've expanded it, and the other is it within it. There's a huge difference, because in the second case, we have our natural autonomy in the midst of our intimacy with the other person. In the first case, the romantic fusion, we don't have that autonomy. We don't have a separation, a necessary separation.
So unfortunately, romantic fusion is pretty much the norm with how many relationships begin, and there's the excitement and the agitation and the heart pounding and the highs and the intense things, and then the huge crash that happens after you realize who the other person really is and how the things don't actually turn out to be what you had assumed.
Mm-hmm. And I think then a lot of people, especially that have no exposure to this work, then maybe continue to seek, how can I get back to that romantic connection, that thinking mm-hmm. that's really what the goal is, maybe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They think there's something wrong with it and that it's missing, but it's that elusive movie idea of romance that they think that they're looking for, when actually they're not even starting out on a solid foundation.
Yes.
Right. Ooh. Well, so maybe for us to paint a picture, even a clearer picture about maybe what radical intimacy can actually look like in real life with real human beings, and that, you know, it's not like we become completely perfect human beings. I mean, we still have the wide range of emotions and fear and anger and all of that, and we have joy and pleasure and excitement and ambition. We have everything, but I don't know. Can we paint? I'm thinking two things. One is either to paint the more real life what radical intimacy can look like, or maybe this is a good way to maybe introduce the stages of evolution in relationship as a way of kind of drawing that picture.
Implicit in all of this, Mary, is relationship. We're always in relationship. Even when we pull away, we're in relationship to our pulling away. There's no escape from relationship. Everything exists through it. So one of the first steps in becoming intimate, prior to becoming radically or deeply intimate, is to consciously develop some more closeness, a deeper connection with the different elements that constitute us, that make us up. That means instead of trying to get away from our anger or fear or insecurity, we take the courageous step of turning toward it, which is a huge step in anyone's work, is turning toward what they normally would turn away from. Not turning toward it too quickly, moving into it too fast, but actually deliberately, intentionally moving toward that painful state. As if to say, this too is me, and I refuse to continue turning away from this or labeling it unspiritual, et cetera, et cetera. I am going to turn toward this, and I am going to choose to cultivate intimacy with it. And once that process is underway, our capacity for intimacy develops and deepens until eventually it is a radical intimacy, meaning it's a very deep, unusually close one. But it begins now. We can begin with just the smallest step toward a quality in ourselves we normally turn away from, and in that tiny step, we are actually starting to develop some intimacy with that.
One more thing here is that
part of this process means not allowing perfectionism to pollute the process.
There's a good one.
You have to go past that, cut through that notion of perfection, that you will be free of these qualities, no longer angry, no longer this, no longer that, because that's a fantasy. It's not true. Most developed beings still have all the emotions. They have flaws. The question is, how do we deal with those flaws? How do we deal with those qualities? Do we let them run the show, or do we take better care of them?
Mm-hmm. So I think we can just take one simple example, Mary, for about turning towards the difficult stuff and turning towards the part in ourselves, say, that we're not wanting to face. Let's just take a man who might have had a childhood where he learned to withdraw. He learned that where he was not safe to show his emotions. He would be ridiculed or shamed or hit. And he learned to hold his feelings in, because that was safety. That wasn't neurotic. It was survival.
Mm-hmm.
And then say he gets into a marriage, and his wife is deeply feeling, and he has his automatic default when there's any confrontation or anything, any place where he feels uncomfortable, is to numb out and dissociate or to withdraw in some way. And that, of course, creates a lot of problems because the woman will take it personally and it can just go on, and then she can inadvertently shame him for it. But if he is consciously starting to turn towards and work on, and good psychotherapy, work on what were the roots of that, and to let himself go back into that, and part of that process means he's got to feel. He's got to feel what happened back then and to work, do work in order to heal that so that he doesn't keep going into that as an automatic in his relationship now. That's just one example, but it's turning towards something that's very painful that people don't want to turn towards. They want to forget about it.
Yes, and once such a person has turned toward his or her numbness or tendency to withdraw, they will still feel that tendency, but they'll be less likely to act it out. They could even, for example, say to their partner, I feel myself pulling back, I feel myself shutting down, and to say it without acting it out is a huge step. Very doable.
Mm-hmm.
And then in relationship, when both people know each other's histories and you're working on it, then you can, that one partner can sometimes recognize what's happening for the other person even before they've realized that they've gone into that automatic default.
And a truly healthy relationship is one in which there's a sense of sanctuary for such work. It's a safe space to expose these difficult, painful parts of ourselves. And the relationship is also a crucible. It's a place where there's enough heat and challenge to keep things from getting stagnant or dead. But that challenge coexists with an incredibly deep nurturance.
Love that. Gosh, both a sanctuary and a crucible.
Yep, simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe I love this example, too, because I imagine many of our men, well, on the line can relate to this, and certainly many women can relate to men in that way. Maybe give us another example of, let's say, a woman, like, feeling into her own, let's say, insecurity. So I think it's so almost unnatural for most of us to think, let's see, since I am more moving away from that, wanting to cover it up, it's generally not the most natural inclination. Oh yeah, let's dive into my insecurity.
Well, you know what? The real growth is where we want to keep things covered up, where we don't want to go. We don't grow from just the highs, pleasant as those can be. We grow when things are difficult and we choose to turn toward them and face them with our partner and work with it.
Mm-hmm.
There's enormous growth in that. So if a woman's really insecure, and a lot of that is based on her earlier history, that she takes it as a given that she's insecure and she wants constant reassurance, the man is letting her down if he just simply reassures her everything's going to be fine, or you are beautiful, or you're this, that, and the other. If he does that, he's basically dealing with her symptoms. Whereas if he's more compassionate, more mature, more awakened, instead of doing that, he'll lovingly, compassionately point her toward the insecurity and be with her, almost sitting beside her in a sense, psychologically and emotionally, as she faces that insecurity and realizes that the way to deal with insecurity ultimately is to get close enough to it, to not just be intimate with it, but to embrace it,
mm-hmm.
to find a certain security in holding the insecure part of ourselves very close, as if it's a wounded, frightened child. And when two people do that together without shaming each other, that insecurity becomes a place of growth. It doesn't lead to more insecurity, it leads to more grounding and more tolerance for states. Like, we all get insecure at times or feel ungrounded or scared. How lovely to stop making ourselves wrong for that, and to simply say that too is me, and to bring that into our heart, to embrace that part of ourselves with compassion.
So let's say that on a practical level, if we had a woman come in who said, you know, I'm so insecure, and I get threatened by even a picture in a magazine, blah, blah, blah. And then what we would do is we would go back into and review different parts of her life where she felt like she wasn't enough, or in the beginning where she became shamed, maybe during puberty, or maybe having a mother that always told her she was too fat. Or, I mean, there's quite a mixture of things that we hear all the time for things that create that sense of not being enough. And it's really rampant, especially when you come into our culture that's just obsessed with looks and youth. And so we would go into those places and actually have her, while we're doing the work, and we also, I think you know that we work with the body too, so we'd be doing body work and we would be doing emotional work about those times, letting her speak out the things that she needed to say, really letting her feel how she felt at that time, and then to realize there's probably a place in her that has rejected that young person that she felt wasn't attractive. A place of repulsion maybe in herself where she needs to learn how to embrace that young woman, that young girl herself, and have that and work on loving that. And there's all different ways that we do that. But eventually what would happen is if she was in a mature relationship, she could share that with her husband and say, "Well, I just realized that I got this pang in my gut just now, and I realized that that 11-year-old girl just really got triggered. I mean, I could feel, I know that that's what this is, but I'm feeling this right now." And he would sit there and be with her in that and not shame her or even just try to pump her up with a pep talk.
Not try to fix her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really just to kind of...
And that's really simplified because there's so much more, but in the amount of time we have, at least I think that will help a little bit illustrate it.
And
yeah.
What Diane's describing is a sense of being really present for each other, not just present in a detached way, but present emotionally, physically, spiritually, just there and able to listen wholeheartedly, 100% to the other person. And then that presence of such listening will tend to feel an increased sense of safety. We can say more. We can say what's difficult to say. And when we can say what's really hard to say and we're listened to compassionately and clearly, what healing can come out of that? It's enormous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's good.
It requires that both people are doing the work on themselves.
Yep, I can totally see that. Okay, so we've got, I love that we're really naming some concrete steps to moving towards radical intimacy, if only, you know, as a beginning path, but developing closeness for everything in our life, including all the variety of emotions and feelings that we might normally want to shy away from. This really being present for each other, listening wholeheartedly to each other. Any other essential guiding principles that we ought to
Another thing that's very important, and we've alluded to this earlier, is do not disrespect each other. Do not shame each other. A lot of people don't recognize that they're shaming the other person when they say, for example, "I wish you were more of a man," or even more subtle phrases where there's a sense of the rolling of the eyes, some sarcasm. Disrespect destroys relationships, and at its extreme, it becomes pure contempt. When that happens, the couple is really far apart. And it's so important when we're tempted to put the other person down because how dare they say this or that to us or how dare they whatever, we get righteous, we get reactive, and we end up often shaming them. So it's important for a couple to know shame from the inside, know their history with shame. What is shame? What is guilt? When does it manifest? When I'm hit with shame personally, how do I deal with it? It's important to know it inside out so that we become, in a sense, incapable of shaming our partner.
Oh, I love that.
Or if we ever do, we'll recognize it so quickly, we can say right off the bat, "Ah, I'm so sorry." We catch ourselves in the act. If it's not caught, there's a real problem.
I think this is so key, and I have to say, until your work, I was so oblivious to the fact that I could do this to a man that I really loved. And and it's, you know, since, you know, just hearing this conversation and, of course, some of our work together as well, like really being much more aware of when you can say anything that minimizes the other or attacks. Any other examples of how people, because I think most people aren't even aware that they're shaming when, you know, it's, they might write it up as, "Well, I'm just pointing out the facts. I'm just being honest. I'm just being authentic."
Right, and that can really be a mask for being passive-aggressive, too.
Yes.
Especially when there's a should. You should. You should. And yet you do want to be able to challenge your partner. There are times where you absolutely have to talk about what hurts you, what angers you. But what we do with couples is make sure that they're expressing what they're feeling, not the perception about what's going on and saying, well, you're just not there enough for me and you're not, you know, you're not hearing me. Those are all perceptions. But when they stick with, I'm really hurt and I'm really angry or I'm really sad, which sounds simplistic, but it keeps you from going into the big loops that can go on for years.
Mm-hmm. Right, instead of the making wrong and you're not doing this right and
blaming. Blaming and shaming are both two things that can really upset it with where it's not constructive.
You know what's helpful here too is to become more aware of our own reactivity so that when we are reactive, we know it. Instead of acting it out, it means like react means to act something out again and again mechanically. Becoming aware of that makes a huge difference. If we're not aware of that, we will automatically probably shame the other person or do things that are disrespectful. Once we're aware, if we may think we're pointing out something to someone else, for example, and maybe what we're saying is accurate in content, but our delivery has a certain tone to it that is shaming.
Mm-hmm.
So delivery is important. I can't just say innocently, well, I said that to you, and you're having a reaction. That's your stuff. You know
yeah,
what?
That's your stuff. Right, so exactly.
The way I've said it has an impact, and I need to take responsibility for how I deliver my message,
yeah.
However, and not just go, well, I'm accurate. You did drop that dish. You were late. So blah, blah, blah. We're not, in that case, taking into account how we're delivering it. Is the other person in a state where they can really hear it?
Mm-hmm.
See, what we're talking about here is relationship. That means to be connected to the other person, to read them, to feel them, not just to assume that whatever they do in response to us is all their stuff. It isn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's my stuff, their stuff, and there's this thing in between that's called the relationship, the intersubjective space. All three are occurring, and we have to be responsible in all three arenas.
Mm-hmm. Really good.
Yeah, because some people will take too much responsibility for something that happens. Oh, my God, he's unhappy with me. What's that say about me? Like the way an abused child might think. Other people will put it all on the other person. They'll turn the heat that's on them back onto the other person. And suddenly they're focusing on the other person when, in fact, they're the one that should be taking most of the heat.
Yeah, they'll have, like, say a guy is, a woman is complaining about something that's really hurtful to her, and he might say, oh, you're being so controlling. You know, and then that's deflected it completely. He hasn't let in at all what's happening for her, and then she's immediately the one who's feeling guilty about even bringing it up.
And this leads to another major piece. I know we're getting at this quite spontaneously, intuitively,
mm-hmm.
is vulnerability.
As we talk about this further in this call,
these pieces keep falling in, not because we have a paint-by-numbers approach, but here it is now, vulnerability. If both people are vulnerable, this will work really well. If they're not vulnerable and there's a certain defendedness that's not being acknowledged, this process doesn't go very deep.
So how can we expand our vulnerability in relationships? Because intuitively it makes sense, but then when, you know, we're getting the heat of battle, or maybe that's maybe not such a good language, but when we're in the relationship itself, sometimes easier said than done. But tips for expanding vulnerability?
Well,
yeah.
One tip is to be in touch with one's history with it. And for example, if our vulnerability was handled badly when we were younger, we may have a strong tendency to deflect that, to guard against it, to get overly defensive, because vulnerability for us perhaps means danger, lack of love from our old experience. So it's important to do enough self-work so we know our history with it and we actually take that courageous step to become more vulnerable. And to be in a relationship, of course, where there's enough safety to do that. The other person's not going to mock us or put us down or hurt us when we get that open.
Yes, because you have to have that trust.
Yes.
In order to be vulnerable, and there has to be, again, that respect that's there as just a given so that when a person becomes vulnerable, the other one isn't going to use that against them, but that they're actually going to listen and hear it. And part of the safety, too, comes from knowing that you don't have your energy leaking out to other people in the relationship so that you can have it develop that deep enough safety that you can really allow this person to see you and who you really are.
And what do you mean by leaking out to others?
Well, of course, the most obvious one is having affairs.
Right, or even an emotional affair.
Or an emotional affair, but even just energetically, if a person senses that their partner has even a sense of an exit plan, in any way. That like if the relationship gets brought up into question every time they have some kind of really heated argument, you know, I'm out of here, or I want a divorce, or whatever. That's going to create a sense of unsafety. So you can't possibly become vulnerable.
Yeah. So threats and ultimatums, all that, not so good for vulnerability.
Right.
Yeah, you want to feel such a trust in your partner. If your partner is chronically, for example, flirting with other people, sexually flirting, there's a real problem because they may say, oh, stop being so uptight. I'm just nothing's really happening here. But there is a subtle betrayal going on, and it does undermine the relationship. It's not that one has to be super good and repressed and never check, look at other people, but there's a way in which we can be with other people that is clean. And this brings us to another key element of our discussion, which is integrity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in a really healthy relationship, to me, love, awareness, passion, integrity all function as one. And that generates an intimacy that really transforms and deepens our lives. And integrity has to be there. And a lot of us will talk ourselves out of our integrity because we feel a certain lust, we feel a certain greed for something. But I think when we have our integrity and we're grounded in it, there's a very sobering joy that emerges. There's a sense of deep non-situational happiness that comes along with that because we know we're really walking a clear line.
And so part of this integrity is certainly around fidelity and commitment to your partner.
Absolutely.
And what are some other ways that integrity either can show up or not be expressed in a relationship?
I think keeping one's word, if you've vowed not to get sarcastic or cruel and when the heat's on in a relationship, you want to keep your word. If you don't, the trust level drops.
Mm-hmm.
And that also means not promising what you're not capable. Well, some people will promise too much, then of course they fall flat in their face soon after that. It's important to make commitments that align you with a deeper integrity and make sure you're making commitments that you can keep.
Even in the simple things, there have been many couples that have had one of their very difficult issues was that one person would tell the other one many times that they would do even just practical things and they wouldn't follow through, and it would drive the other one really crazy because there was no keeping their word, and so they would lose trust in them and other things because even in the small things it wasn't showing up.
Mm-hmm.
A more obvious example is don't lie. So many,
yeah.
It sounds so simple, but many people will lie, and they'll lie about their lying. There's a denial. It's important to get past the sense that I have a right to lie in a relationship, because lies create distance and more distance, and they militate against any true intimacy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh, really?
And integrity also has to do with the word like integral or integrative. Implicit in that is, of course, here's all these different elements that make me up. My job is not to be fragmented. My job is to be intimate enough with these different pieces of myself so they come together in kind of a sacred reunion, like there's a sense of true wholeness through that. In a really great relationship, both people are made more whole through being together. They become more themselves through being together, not losing themselves in the other person like a lot of cliched notions of relationship imply, but to get really, really individualized.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit on, we talked about safety and actually trust, and in situations where there has been, say, breach in trust, or, you know, like a serious betrayal, or maybe it is just a history of not really keeping word, you know, not taking out the garbage when you say you're going to, or, you know, whatever the errands are that,
yeah.
What tips are there about really deepening that trust for people that are, you know, really wanting to rebuild that? Or is it even possible?
It is possible, but it's very difficult if the betrayal's been large enough. Sometimes it's just you can't go back. In other words, say if you've been betrayed majorly, you may take your partner back, love him, be with him, but you're going to have one eye always on the outlook for further betrayal. You might be tempted to check cell phone, email records. It's really hard to rebuild trust when there's been a major breach. It is possible, but it's very, very difficult.
It takes a lot of work and a lot of time, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The person has to really be convinced that their partner is no longer capable
of doing the same thing.
That they have done enough work on themselves for what motivated them to betray their partner in the first place, and that they are now at a point of maturity that they aren't even capable of doing that. Otherwise, that fear of the mistrust will always be there, even if it's subtle.
So in other words, it's not enough to say you're sorry, even if it's a really deep, remorseful, I'm sorry. You have to demonstrate clearly that you're not capable of that behavior anymore. You can't do that just by saying you're not. You have to actually do the work where you go beyond being capable of that.
Mm-hmm.
There's something else that fits with this a little bit. I think a really healthy man is outgrowing any need for pornography. Now, there are men in what we would call the second stage of intimate relationship, which is like a codependent stage, where they're not doing anything with porn. They're being good. They're being really good, like good boys in a sense, but their desire has not been outgrown. It's simply been buried. It's still sitting there. And it's important, I think, that what's been buried be exhumed, brought to the surface, skillfully, of course, and then worked with. So if a man does still have that pull, once he's exposed it, once he's exposed it, then he can work with it, because it is workable. But it's so easy to bury stuff in the name of security, because, oh, she doesn't want to, my wife wouldn't like this, my husband wouldn't like that. So you put the lid on stuff, and that leads to a couple that could be together a long time, but they're not becoming more vital and alive in their relationship. They're just doing their time, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Not taking any risks.
Yes.
It gets very flat.
Yeah.
So what I'm really getting here is that really it's back to our kind of original focus, which is like we really need to get close and intimate with everything. So it's not like there's certain topics within your beingness and certain desires that, oh, well, like we don't really have to deal with maybe a drive or an interest in pornography or... and I suppose with women, like, you know, some of the big ones are, you know, past histories of rape or assault, issues of abuse in the past. Like,
yeah.
Those are things that ultimately you got to dive into the heart of those.
Critical, yep. Because they will keep a certain amount of distance from going. There's a place of vulnerability that you will not want to go into or feel safe if that wound is still there,
mm-hmm.
It's still not healed.
And it's inevitable that you would project some of that onto the current partner if it's not been worked on. It's inevitable.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about the stages of the stages in the evolution of relationship.
Okay.
Talk a little bit about
sure.
kind of what happens in each one and kind of where we're headed.
Yeah. Because we already mentioned one of them very briefly, the codependent one. Let's start at the beginning. The first one we call me-centered.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of says it all. Like, it's all about me. And the key question in there for people in that stage is, what's in it for me? What's in it for me?
There's an immaturity and an indulgence in that stage. That's where a lot of the affairs happen. It's where people... They're not very conscious.
And they're not aware of their reactivity.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically a very unconscious stage, and it can have moments of great connection, but those are states. They come and they go, and then people may say, because we had such a great connection and we do so well sexually sometimes, therefore who cares about the abuse? But those relationships are never healthy, and we all have the capacity for me-centeredness in relationships. It's not like we leave that stage and it's disappeared. It's more like it's still in us. We just don't act it out.
As the main driving force.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So this is probably a lot of what we see in dramas on movies, and one of my favorite shows, The Bachelor, Bachelorette. Those are great examples of me-centered relationships. Not to pick on my friends.
Lots of heat. So the fire in that stage is, oh, so much heat and passion and juice, but the fire is not, there's no light. It's
right.
Just all heat. And there's a sense of, if you look at it closely behind all the romanticizing of it, it's a lot of desperation.
And there's a lack of self-inquiry. The me-centered people
yes.
do not go for therapy. They do not read books about how to have better communication. It's much more selfish.
Right, and they probably wouldn't find themselves on a call like this.
I was thinking the same thing. But all of us who are on this call have that tendency, so we can have some compassion for that stage. But
exactly.
If you're fully at that stage, you'd be thinking, this no way I go near a call like that. That's just no, not for me.
Right. Okay, so that's one-centered, and me-centered.
That's one. And then when there's enough suffering in that stage, here's what's true often. If there's enough suffering and heartbreak, often that will cause the people to wake up a little more and they'll move on. That's the sad truth. Often if the suffering is not strong enough, we can stay stuck in that for the rest of our lives. I mean, many people consider it a fortunate thing when something very difficult happens, when they're stuck back there and they are literally vaulted into a deeper level of being. But it's very painful at first because they're being stretched way beyond their comfort zone. So the second stage is, we call it we-centered. The people are more connected as a couple, codependent. So it's codependency. And in other words, the people's neuroses match and they get kind of entwined and they become what we would call a cult of two.
Mm.
The first stage, I would say, is two cults of one having an affair, a battle, and some far from sacred combat. And the second stage, it's like a cult of two. It's just like they're walled in against the rest of the world. And whatever would threaten the relationship is kind of buried, pushed aside, so the people are nice. They don't fight that much.
And they don't really deal with the hard stuff. They just sort of ignore it.
They coast.
Push it away.
Right. Well, and this could be a situation where maybe there's a woman that's more tendency to be a martyr and give and contribute and please the man, and the guy that's more controlling, that might be a good we-centered match in that let me just do whatever the guy wants, but of course, unless one of them starts growing and evolving.
Yeah. It's like a deal has been struck, and they basically don't want to rock the boat. The first stage, people rock the boat, but not for a higher good, just because they're very egocentric. Second stage, we don't rock the boat because we don't want to make waves. We don't want to upset things. Yes, we haven't had sex for 10 years, but we're still, there's that sort of resignation. And many people stay stuck there, but again, sometimes there's enough suffering or something happens that's unusual. They're broken into what I would call the third stage, which is, it's a mouthful. It's we-centered, because it's still, people are connected as a couple. We-centered co-independent. Not codependent, co-independent. That means both people have their autonomy, but they have too much of it.
Mm.
It's natural, because people have been kind of squashed. They've been trapped in relationship. Now they get to be more independent. And they're not about to throw that away, so they tend to overvalue their autonomy, undervalue the communion, the connection, the intertwinement between them.
Okay, so this is like thinking of couples that say they've been married maybe a long time, but, well, my husband and I are more like roommates, and we maybe go on separate vacations and have our own interests. We're still good friends, but not a lot of passion here.
Mm-hmm.
And that could also end up being the codependent, but it is more co-independent, but you can have a deeper form of we-centered co-independent where people are still, they value the relationship, and but that is not the priority for them. And they do lots of things independently, and they do things together, but there is still a distance.
And there's also an awakening, because both people are now cherishing their autonomy and individuality. The previous stage, there's no development of one's individuality. In this stage, at least one's individuality is being recognized and nurtured, but unfortunately at the expense of the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a relatively mature stage to be at, but because in it there's the seeds of the fourth stage, which we call being centered.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear about that one.
Yeah, which many everyone has tastes of that, no matter how immature they are, but as a stage, it's the place where much of what we talked about earlier in this call is manifest most of the time. It's not that a being-centered couple has reached perfection, but their inclination is to turn toward the difficult.
Mm-hmm.
To cultivate intimacy with what they are. There's a deep empathy between them. There's a lot of awakening. There's a sense of mutual spiritual opening.
And respect.
And huge respect. And a willingness to push the edge somewhat. It's not just all safe and cozy. There's a sense of deep growth.
Mm-hmm.
So there is challenge, but it's done in a healthy way so that it's not shaming and it's not the earlier stages, it's more like a fierce compassion. Where you can really not lose touch with your heart, but still step in where it's needed.
And so here it sounds like we really need two willing participants to dive in and be with anything and that really want that extra opening.
And who truly value using intimate relationship as a vehicle for awakening and healing. It's not just on paper. They really, really get that. And it's not for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But for some people, it's an incredible vehicle for growth. You know, I've called it elsewhere the ashram of the 21st century, you know, intimate relationship at the deepest level. Everything that we need to work on gets brought to the surface through such a relationship. But, of course, it requires that both people be relatively mature.
Mm-hmm.
And that they have done work, they have done the healing work on themselves or are continuing to do so, because it's not an end. It's a stage, and you can have certainly many times where when you're tired or stressed, a person in a being-centered relationship will have a state of, you know, just of any of the other stages. And yet there's always more to learn. There's always more to grow and to deepen. It's not just a goal. It's a stage, and it just keeps on. You just keep on growing.
And this is one of the distinctions you make: the difference between states and stages. So we've just talked about the four stages: me-centered, we-centered, co-independent, or codependent,
mm-hmm.
we-centered, co-independent, and being-centered. So those are our four stages. And then maybe just to clarify the difference between stages and states.
Well, state is an arising. It's relatively short-lived, like a mood, a certain emotion
temporary kicks
in. One may feel really great for a couple of hours, but it's very ephemeral. It passes. It's transient. A stage is more permanent. I mean, one can go in and out of stages, but if one's at a certain stage, say, of cognitive development, that's our base. We don't regress back and become pre-rational for the rest of our lives, for example. But in short, I mean, state is a temporary arising, and we can often mistake what happens in a state, like a profound sense of oneness with the divine can happen at any stage of development. So if I'm a rabid fundamentalist and I have that experience of divine oneness, I will interpret it to mean that my way really is the way, which is problematic.
Mm.
If you're much more mature, you would interpret it in a much different way. It might deepen your sense of universal compassion, et cetera. So the stage we're at is very important.
Mm-hmm.
To know.
But you know what's interesting, Mary, is that and having the book written and describing everything so that people can really become more intimate with where they are, who they are, what they have to work on, what their relationship might be. Actually, when we are working with a couple, we never name that stage to ourselves.
No.
And say, oh, they're co-independent. That doesn't even ever come up in the work or with each other, because we're working with what we see shows up that isn't working, and it just all works together. It's not like we dissect it and analyze it. We just jump in where it is.
No, it's a bit like an orienting map for those that are reading what I've written.
Right.
Right, right. Well, and I think that's the kind of key thing is really if we take anything that's not working, no matter what stage we're in, anything that's not working, if we're willing to dive into it and face
yes.
it full-heartedly, we're going to really be able to grow our relationship further.
It's a bit like
Absolutely.
Two people that want to deepen their trust. One of the first things they'll probably have to do, if there's good guidance around, is expose where the mistrust is.
Mm-hmm.
You want to deepen the trust. In other words, you have to say, okay, here's where I don't have full trust. And to say it openly without shaming or being shamed, and just then it can be worked with.
Mm-hmm.
Something else that's helpful here, too, is to look at the whole spectrum from me-centered to being-centered in a different way, which is to say that at one end we have what we would call immature monogamy, very immature monogamy. The other extreme would be, the spectrum would be, being-centered, what we could call it mature monogamy, or we're calling it now awakened monogamy.
Mm-hmm.
Immature monogamy entraps or doing time in it. Mature monogamy, awakened monogamy, liberates.
Mm-hmm.
Those that have reached monogamy at that level don't feel trapped by it. They're not trapped by it. they're open to life more. They're serving in a higher good because they're in such a relationship. And in between, there's all kinds of variations in that spectrum from immature to mature.
Mm-hmm. Right, beautiful, beautiful.
And at the same time, even the most mature person or couple will have times of immaturity. That is natural. Of course it arises. The question then is, how do they deal with it?
And I think that is a really, really key thing, because it could be really easy and be a open playground for shaming our partner. It's like, oh my gosh, you're doing this. That's more like you're being a me-centered person. That's not, or, you know, you're being totally codependent, you know.
Right, right. That would not be helpful.
Not the way to use this information, just as a sidebar here.
We can get so subtle in relationship, we can use almost anything to further our own point if we're reactive enough, including the highest spiritual truth.
Yeah.
I'm one, but you're not. You know, it's like that. It's ridiculous.
Right.
What's crucial there is to be very aware of our intentions, our motivations for saying what we say, doing what we do.
Yeah. That's a big one.
It's like a man could be very vulnerable and emotionally resonant with a woman, very empathetic, but be doing it for an ulterior motive to have her become sexual with him. What he's doing is authentic, but it's also what's not so authentic is the motivation, which is not being exposed.
Right.
So it's so important to know what's driving us and when we're speaking. We're not just necessarily all clean cut in what we're doing. We want to be very aware of where we're coming from when we bring things forward.
Boy, there's a whole other category for us to get close and intimate with is our intentions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. And to be aware of them, fully aware.
Well, and there's another big playground that it's a relationship call, so we've got to talk a little about sex. How does sex complement or hinder our growth?
I'd say right off the bat, it hinders our growth when we use it to make ourselves feel better or more secure. In other words, we assign sex to the task of making us feel better or more secure. And then we tend to over-rely on it. Say in a relationship where things aren't going well, we may rely too much on the fact that when we're being sexual, at least there's some release, we feel pretty good. But that kind of robs us of the very energy we need to face what's not working in the relationship.
So if things are not going well sexually, so much of the time, it's a symptom of what's happening in the relationship. And couples many times will use sex and different techniques and different routines and things to try to create a sense of intimacy, but it's really not deep intimacy. It's just made it feel better for the time being, but they haven't dealt with what's really going on.
In other words, if two people are not connected sexually very well, instead of us giving them some techniques, tantric and otherwise, to improve that, we will instead explore with them the roots of their distance from each other. And when that is cleared up, then they're more connected. Then sex is a natural flowering or outgrowth of such connection. So we often teach, and put it very simply, don't have sex to get connected,
mm-hmm.
in order to be connected. Instead, connect first, be already loose, already happy, already connected. Then if sex is natural, let it flow from that without any techniques, books to rely on. Just let it flow out of your already present connection and love and communion.
In fact, we would work with a couple to heal their emotional connection first and actually have non-sexual touch.
Yes.
Still affectionate touch, but to focus on not to let the sex distract them from what's really needing work.
Uh-huh.
Healing.
Yeah, I think this is and this is one of the big topics you write about in spiritual bypassing, that
yes.
a lot of our culture uses sex as a way to escape and cover up those feelings. In fact, it's probably worth just speaking a minute to spiritual bypassing. And as I do, it's I've got 5 minutes to the hour, and we can either end the call like right at the top, or we could maybe go an extra 15 minutes. What's your schedule?
Let's go longer.
Sure.
I was kind of thinking that we would do this call a little bit longer.
Yeah.
So for our listeners, we're not wrapping up yet.
We're getting warmed up.
Yeah, exactly. I know. It's like we're getting into some really good stuff. But just to speak to spiritual bypassing, for people that missed the first call.
Well, spiritual bypassing means using spiritual practices and beliefs to avoid dealing with unresolved wounds, painful emotions, developmental needs. And it's extremely common. It's very pervasive because it's often not recognized as such. For example, someone's got a lot of pain, a lot of fear, and they're doing a certain meditative practice that helps them rise above that. And they feel good when they're doing it. But when they come down from it, there's the fear, there's the pain. It's sitting there. And then they're told, well, if you did your practice more fully, this wouldn't happen. So they make it all about themselves. They meditate more, do more mantras. They do more New Age affirmations, whatever it is. And if they don't achieve that freedom from fear, which they've been promised, then they feel like something's wrong with me. Then a certain heavy-duty shame will creep in. That's one aspect of it. Another is blind compassion, which, of course, infects many relationships. It means, in short, not really challenging the other, cutting them way too much slack, always be nice. Someone's really hurt you, say, well, maybe they had a rough childhood, and who am I to judge them? And we talk ourselves out of what I would call a healthy challenge or healthy confrontation if someone's hurt us.
Mm-hmm.
These things can happen because we associate being nice and sweet and kind all the time with being spiritual, whereas real spirituality to me is a real fire. Sometimes there's a lot of heat. It's not just this quiet, benign process. It really asks a lot of us.
Mm-hmm.
So these things can, of course, affect our relationships with everyone and
yes.
how we relate to our life. Then you take it into an intimate relationship and say you have a guy who just does 3 hours of meditation a day, and he's really deeply peaceful, and he never gets emotional with his wife or vulnerable because he's kind of risen above that and transcended it, when actually there's, you know, he's removed himself from relationship, but he spiritualized it.
Hmm. Right, and that might be a version of the we-centered co-independent being manifested.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think you're right.
With a big layer of spiritual bypassing.
Yeah. I call it dissociation and spiritual drag.
Yeah.
And we have all kinds of ways of getting away from the painful. You know, we can do it sexually, narcotically. We can use our spirituality. But as we said earlier, the big step, huge step for us, is when we choose to turn toward the uncomfortable or the painful in our lives, and we turn toward it with awareness
mm-hmm.
and compassion.
Well, and that's one of the, what we've been talking about all along is really about diving into those less comfortable emotions and states and exploring them, as opposed to if we just kind of put them under the carpet, that's also a version of spiritual bypassing.
It is, yeah.
Right.
Anything we don't want to deal with. Great. Well, and I'm going to ask, I asked the question only because I put it out on Twitter beforehand, and one of the questions that came back, and I hadn't heard it before, but is that, well, is spiritual bypassing something that psychotherapists have just come up with as a way to, because they're afraid of losing their practices and wanting to get more business, because it's helpful to have a psychotherapist to dive into the deep emotional stuff. So,
oh my. You know, it's so funny because our job, the way we look at it, is to have the client not need us anymore. And that's and the work is very efficient, and we never, you know, go on for years and years with someone. So, I mean, it's just, I'll let Robert answer that because that's spiritual bypassing, but it's almost kind of funny.
I mean, spiritual bypassing is so much more than that. It's such a narrow, narrow take on it. I think it's quite inaccurate.
Yeah.
And spiritual bypassing is found wherever you have spiritualities. I think it's gone on for millennia. The places where we see the most spiritual bypassing is where we see the most spiritual practices not being taken, like where we are here in California, Boulder,
mm-hmm.
West Coast of Canada, parts of Europe. Of course it's there. Of course many people get into spirituality not because they really want to come home to the divine and fully awaken. That's quite rare in the beginning. It's more like they feel like, here's a place where I can feel some peace. Here's where I get a break from my relationship hassles or the pain of my past. Most of us enter it for less than noble reasons. But if we stay with it, we start to see through what initially brought us to it and actually get authentically into it.
And I would venture a guess that most people want to stop their suffering. They want to get away from their pain. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that if they are using spiritual practices to not also go to the roots of it, then they're going to have a problem, because they can practice for decades and still have those things sitting there and still have those things affecting their relationship.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's where something like law of attraction, which has become really popularized because of The Secret. And I think there are people that want to apply law of attraction also in relationship, that, you know, I'm just going to focus on feeling good, and that's going to help shift my, you know, the vibration, my vibration, and in relationship. And is that an effective strategy?
No, I don't think so. I think it's more important to shift from doing that to being authentic.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'd be better for a person in that situation to say what's really going on, not just to keep trying to be in a different state. Because the very effort to be somewhere else says that I have a problem with where I'm actually at.
Mm-hmm.
Why not expose that? Why not work with that? There's more growth there. The other thing can happen early on. There's nothing wrong with it being an early stage of self-work to do that. But after all, one realizes that that's not going to really make you happy. What's going to make you really happy, really happy, is to stop distracting yourself from your suffering. The way I put it is, it's important to make your longing to be truly, truly free more central or more important than your desire to distract yourself from your suffering. So instead of trying to get away from it, you turn toward it. You take the drama out of it, then you're just sitting with your pain. Everyone has pain. Pain's part of life. The thing is, how do we work with it?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, the best way to work with it is to go toward it, get intimate, move through it, rather than try and rise above it, get away from it.
Or manipulate it in some
yeah.
other way.
Or take something like the Secret and some of the more atrocious lines there. I remember where someone doesn't have any money. Well, it's because they're not thinking correctly. So you tell that to some starving mother in the Sudan or something. If you just change your thoughts, excuse me, we know that it's magical thinking. It's too simplistic. And, of course, it does apply in certain ways. You look how people are drawn together through their conditioning. But that law can be misused. And, again, our motivation is crucial. Are we doing what we're doing with it because of our greed? We want more. Or do we believe people tell us we can have it all, et cetera, et cetera?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, and this is kind of points to triggers that might allow us to kind of turn back in towards our pain, turn back towards what we need to get more intimate with. So maybe the impulse to want to pull out law of attraction principles could be a signal, hey, let's turn inward. What are some other kind of clues, especially for some, let's say a couple that's maybe transitioning or wants to transition between one of the we-centered co-independent to being centered? What are like some clues that they need to dive in as opposed to?
Well, one would be that there's a certain decrease in satisfaction with their lives, despite
mm-hmm.
the independence, perhaps the money, the perks. There's a sense of hollowness, or not, this is not enough, or I've reached a plateau.
Or a sense of a longing.
And then what that couple can do, and we see couples like this sometimes, you don't have to just be really messed up to do really deep couples work. You could already have a good relationship, a great one even, and take it deeper. What I would say to someone in that position is, do some deep work as a couple and individuals, despite your resistance to that. Do it, dive in, have the humility to let that happen and see what occurs, what arises. Because to go to that deeper level, you have to get more vulnerable, you have to have clearer boundaries, and you have to know yourself at a deeper level. You can't just take jump because it sounds good or because there's five easy steps to it. There aren't five easy steps to it. It's an existential leap.
There might be a clue, Mary, of say that you're needing to go from that stage to the next step. Maybe besides the longing or the dissatisfaction, maybe that you're finding the person is finding themselves strategic, like being,
yes.
you know, thinking about, well, let's see, how could I bring this up because I'd really like this to have happen instead of just directly talking about what's going on or not leaving something till later because I this year I don't want to bring this up or. There's a lack of transparency.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's a big clue, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as soon as you get strategic, you know that there's a way in which you're not really trusting the relationship fully.
Yeah.
In a really healthy relationship, there's no sense of strategy. There's just simple transparency, openness, empathy, and attunement. And out of that attunement, what needs to happen flows quite naturally. You don't have to get strategic about it or consult a book at all at any level.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking about how to go deeper in relatively healthy relationships. But, you know, we also need to address that there are relationships where people have chosen each other out of their conditioning, from their unhealed places, and that just fits their history, that fits the energetic that they've had, and they're actually destructive. They're actually relationships that are not, even if you do some of these, some of this work, they're not going to be full alignments. They're not going to be healthy things, and that's a sobering reality to sometimes come to realizing why you have chosen the partner you're with, and sometimes that person is not willing to work on it. Sometimes both people can do a lot of work and realize, oh, you know, this really is not a good fit for this other person.
Mm-hmm.
And that is part of the picture.
I can see how, and I think that's one of the things you talk about in the book around relationship infecting delusions, having a belief, a thought of I can't live without you might be one of the things that, hey, I don't know that I want to rock the boat and go do some deep work.
Right, because look what might happen. We might have to face that maybe we shouldn't be together.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be, you know, that's scary.
When we're working with a couple, we never have the intention or our interior plan to have them either separate or stay together. Our job is to help them feel the deepest truth between them beyond just the concept of truth. When two people are sitting in that zone, there's a knowingness between them as to what the appropriate form of the relationship is. It doesn't come from us. Our job is to help them reach that place. And then in that place, they can mutually arrive at, do we continue with this? And if so, what do we need to do? Or perhaps this is just not workable enough for one or both of us, and we need to part lovingly as possible.
But one thing that we do say is if a couple comes that are, they're pretty much on that crossroads and they're ready to split, we will say, why not then go all out for the next 3 to 6 months and really both of you throw yourselves into your own personal work, do the couple's work, really know that you have given it all,
everything
that you can, so that if it does come down to you parting, that it can be done with respect and love and peace and honoring the relationship that you had.
And
otherwise, they've left it too soon.
Yes.
Right.
Because you can stay too long and you can leave too soon.
And I imagine there's plenty of cases where people really thought they were on the verge of leaving and it was impossible, and got willing to dive in and ended up in
that.
We love seeing that when that happens. Two people think they are done and they do the work. Things are exposed. A deeper level of relationality emerges, and suddenly, a few months down the road, they are now reconnected, but they haven't gone back to how they were. It's like a new relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So that can happen.
Often.
And it's very gratifying.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, and it seems one of the other triggers for us that if we're in a reactive place, that's also a good time, once again, emotionally, to turn back around, dive in, seize the opportunity.
Yes, and then that begins with the simple words, I am being reactive. You notice that it may be a little bit of pride that gets in the way of saying that, but there it is. I'm being reactive, and therefore whatever I'm saying now is colored by that emotional knot I've tied myself up in, and it's probably not going to be that accurate. So I better just take a few breaths and talk about my reactivity instead of going on and on about what the other person has done or hasn't done.
So we have to be familiar with our reactivity. We have to be familiar with what we get triggered by and how that shows up.
Mm-hmm. And all the signs. Some it could be the heart closes, our shoulders get tight, we suddenly feel suspicious of our partner, our guts rumble in a certain way. Each of us has our own unique signs that reactivity is kicking in.
Mm-hmm. Our voice could jump up an octave, or our eyebrows go straight up, or we start getting very, very loud. And
exactly.
Right, or wanting to withdraw and leave the room or something.
I know.
Oh, yeah, that's a big one.
Yeah.
Just shutting down. Boom. There it is. Not even be going numb or just not even feeling connected.
Oh, so many good signs.
You know what's interesting is when a person does hit that numb place to and feeling disconnected, to say, "Oh, I really feel disconnected right now. I feel numb. I don't feel right now." To even say that, reestablishes a connection, because that's taking a risk, and it is being vulnerable and transparent in that. It's not blaming the other person for what they said made me feel numb. It's just simply, wow, I'm really numb right now.
Mm. Well, and these are some great tips for kind of navigating reactivity, conflict, jealousy. Want to give us a few more tips around how we can navigate these kind of, well, reactivity or power struggles in relationships?
I think we've kind of covered it in a very spontaneous way. It begins with being aware of it and naming it.
Because
you can be aware of it and then refuse to say, because you're not going to give the partner that benefit. You know, we can be like that. But once we said it out loud, then we have to do something different. We have to shift our awareness, for example, to our breathing, maybe be quiet for a little bit, maybe say, here's what I'm really feeling. Instead of going on and about the other person's problems, you usually say, God, I feel really sad right now, or my guts hurt, or I'm so angry, I could scream. Whatever it is, there's that step, and it sounds simple, but it's a big step.
Mm-hmm.
And if we start with that, two people can actually both take responsibility for their own reactivity and work to not have that run the relationship or pollute it in any way. That's a major thing to do.
It is, and what Robert just said about naming it is actually something that's critical, because we can be reacting to something, say, insecurity, and we're lashing out and picking fault with the other person or doing things that we think are actually about those things. But what's really happening is that we're in a reactive state right then. And to name it is a huge step into being able to work with it, with each other and with ourselves. We may realize that there's a certain place in our body where we suddenly go, ugh, when we hit that. And to say, wow, that my solar plexus just contracted. And, I'm feeling reactive right now. I've got a real strong sense of insecurity.
You know, something else we haven't brought in very much, I want to do in this call now, is spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
For what we're talking about, to really work optimally, both people need to have some sort of spiritual practice. In other words, if you have that, then you'll be more mindful of when reactivity kicks in, because you're more used to observing your inner processes while you sit in meditation. And you can also, in the midst of a reactive bout, you could both stop and just have eye contact and both be commit to being aware of each breath and just eye gaze. And just to let things settle, so you both become aware again of the bigger picture, the bigger reality, the fact that you're mortal. We're only here for a short time. Here we are, and you start to feel your love and compassion for the other person. You feel compassion even for the reactive place in yourself or him or her, and things start to shift. So that capacity to go into the spiritual, into that deeply aware, organically natural place is essential.
Right. And so interestingly enough, the spiritual practice in this way helps you become more present. Present with what's arising, really.
There's no bypassing.
Instead of leaving it behind, it's actually dropping in and being very present and using it as a way to deepen the relationship rather than to leave it.
Mm-hmm. Right, because, boy, being present is one of the key tools and skills to have front and center.
Yep.
Yes.
And you cultivate that presence for yourself, your partner does, and then the relationship itself, there's more of a sense of presence, there's more space for things to happen in, there's more safety.
And you go into, you do the work to find out what is it that makes me not present, what is it that makes me want to leave, and work with that.
That's really good. Well, I know some of the readers of Power of Inner Choice know about Now Practices, which is a practice of practicing being present.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's more required than being here now. That what's important is to be here now, to be present. But then it's also very important to take fitting action based on them. That's where a lot of meditation falls short.
Mm-hmm.
We can be sitting in deep Vipassana meditation, very aware of everything that's arising, not pushing any of it away, which is great, but we may be less prone to act on it. So we may end up at that point not sitting with our anger, but sitting on it. We're not, perhaps there's a need to actually literally express it to certain people in our lives, and we're just sitting there watching it and not pushing it away. So that sense of taking action based on our presence, being really aware of what's occurring in the moment, is very important.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we can get passive, and then we can spiritualize our passivity by saying, well, I'm just watching the flow of life come and go. That's not enough for relationship.
Right, and that's also a form of blind compassion.
Yes.
Yes. Wow. There are so many more things that we could continue talking about.
You could go on all day, Mary.
I know. It's well, and this is why you lead multiple day workshops, isn't it?
Right.
And I know, I was so excited to hear this because I know in July you did a 5-day retreat, 4 or 5 days?
A full week.
Seven days.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
7 days, and I had heard it might be your last one, and you guys had so much fun that you're doing another one in October. Do you want to share just a little about that?
Great. We had, a person from England and Denmark and
Mexico.
Canada and Mexico and all over the States, one person from Ashland, and what we loved about it was that finding out that with a full week, we had so much time for each person to do individual work multiple times and to talk and in depth and to have meditation times and do a couple of evenings with music. And it just was so fulfilling because we didn't feel like we'd left people with before they'd had a chance to really get to the bottom of some of our things. And so now we've decided, okay, well, this is great. Let's do this. Ashland's a wonderful place for people to come to.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and so we've started another group for the last week of October, and it's already half full, just as we've let people know just in this past week.
And we have more men than women so far, which is a miracle.
And this is not something you need to be a couple to go to. You can go as
an
individual.
No, this actually is not for couples, right. This is more for individuals.
Yeah.
Okay.
We do intensives where we have maybe a couple will come for, say, 3 days, 4 days, however long they can be here, and do a couple hours a day each one will do an individual hour with us so that we really get a good sense of that person's history and what they have. And then we work with the couple several times over the next few days for maybe an hour and a half or 2 hours at a time.
Which is what John and I did, and not because our relationship is, it's horrible, and you know we're on the verge of divorce. Not even close to that. I can really attest that spending that weekend really has been a catalyst for a really sweet deepening of intimacy in our relationship. And so I'm really grateful, and I think it's a lovely way to do work. And we loved our weekend in Ashland. Besides that,
I know. There's so much here that's great.
And of course, we also do intensives for individuals, too.
Yes, we do.
People come from different places around the world for maybe 2, 3, 4 days, and we just work with them probably for 5 or 6 hours. And, you know, then there's a follow-through. If they wanted to follow through, they can do phone work with me, and then they can maybe come back sometime later in the year.
Well, the 6 hours are spread out over, because our work is very efficient, and there's a lot that happens in a two-hour time. So we'll spread it out and then let them digest, go for a walk, journal, give them some homework, and then come back the next day.
And then you also do one-on-one work over the phone. So
yes,
with both couples and individuals. So
yeah, but you know what I'm finding when I do that? I mean, we have an hour with them. Usually at the end of it, I say, well, they say, what's the next step? The next step is when you can come to Ashland for 3 or 4 days, and we'll just take this deeper. Because the phone work is great, but the in-person, of course, there's much more we can
and
do.
And with a couple, it's much more effective in person.
Yeah,
I can really imagine that because of some of the processes you do, and I can't imagine my relationship without having had the experience with you.
No, and the body work is essential. We do body work a lot, and it's because it's very efficient, very effective. It's very connected to the psychotherapeutic parts of the session. On the phone, I can give people suggestions around their bodies and give them certain directions and have them finish in complete sentences. But I'm always left with, I wish that person was sitting in front of me, in front of us.
That's the best.
Yeah.
So the best way for people to learn more about your week and working with you is?
to contact us via email, you know, info@robertmasters.com is probably the best, info@robertmasters.com. And my website has a lot of material too, robertmasters.com. That's where the one-week group is advertised, which is now half full.
And I just to say, you limit that to only
12 people for the whole week.
That way we have lots and lots of time for each person to get individual attention.
And what we found in the last one was, you know, the sense of safety was created in like the first hour, and the group just became like a small community, and the work got deeper and deeper, more and more primal, more natural, more spiritual breakthroughs as it went along that were happening spontaneously. And it was such a delight to be with them. I thought this might be my last group because, you know, but I was so energized by it. I thought at the end of it, let's do one of these every 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
It's
wow.
So lovely.
I think
I screen everyone who comes too, so we don't have any problems. So sometimes I have to turn people away who aren't ready for
that.
We
want to make sure that it's a good fit for them too. Sometimes it's better for a person to do an individual intensive rather than a group situation. So we always have Robert give a free talk on the phone with them,
yeah,
you know, to consult. And I want to mention too that we do have masterscenter.net is our free website with just tons of articles that Robert's written. There's videos of us, video clips on different topics, just quite a bit of things there, and a forum for people that want to ask questions. So that's another way to be in touch with us. And then my website is dianebardwell.net, and that has the music that you referred to earlier, Mary, in the beginning of the call. We've just finished literally this week getting my new Western Contemporary Chant CD in English that we use in our groups. We have people chant and sing together, and that's what this collection is. So,
yeah, so that, congratulations on that, because I know this was not a just, let's go in the recording studio and we'll whip this out. This
is
like
almost 2 years, I think, to really finally get it.
And
we're actually looking into making a Spanish version of it next.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so we'll have the same instrumentation, but I'll do all the lyrics in Spanish.
They sound great in Spanish.
They do.
Wow. Well, I know a lot of heart, soul, and work went into the layering of what's on that CD Emergence. So I hope a lot of people will choose to pick that up as, of course, the book Spiritual Bypassing, if it's not already in your library and on your nightstand.
Transformation Through Intimacy, I'll just say this briefly, I've just revised it, and I'll be revising it further in a month or two with an editor from North Atlantic Books, and it'll be published by them next spring. The same title, subtitle will be The Journey Toward Awakened Monogamy.
Oh.
And the interior will be revised, and I'm going to give a lot of examples of how couples at each stage deal with things like reactivity, conflict.
We'll have sample couples, you know, in each
yeah,
aspect of that,
yeah,
talking.
So that will be out next March. But for now, people can always get, they can either get a PDF of the book from me because it's out of print now,
or
they can go to Amazon.com and get it on Kindle.
Okay.
But the new hardcover will be available in the spring through Random House.
Oh, well, congratulations on that.
Yeah.
I enjoy my copy of the book. I will keep it as
is. You got one of the last ones.
Oh, I'm very, very glad.
Yeah.
And I also just have to say, too, Robert, you are really generous on your fan page on Facebook. So I've gotten on there a few times, people, you know, different topics, like really diving deeper into some of the same kind of ideas here and a whole lot more. This duo is a wealth of wisdom. So I hope moving forward they become staples in your lives in many ways. So, well, I so appreciate having both of you here and extended conversations with the Masters. Any closing thoughts as we wrap up for today?
Well, we sure have enjoyed this. This is our favorite topic.
We just love talking about this topic. We live it. We work with it all the time. It's a pleasure. And I know you're into it too, Mary, and you did a great job with us today. So it's just been a pleasure doing this. I'm looking forward to actually hearing the whole call when we play it back later.
Yeah, well, it will be available later this afternoon. And those of you that are listening live, look for some follow-up notes later this week. And I just want to thank all of you for your time and attention today and for your own commitment to yourself on your own personal growth and evolution. And with that, everyone have a fantastic rest of the day.
Thank you, Mary.
Bye, Thank Diane. You. Bye, Robert. Thank you,
Thank
you so
bye.
Much. Bye, everyone.
Bye. Bye.